Ladies and gentlemen, please give a warm Detroit Economic Club welcome to Jim and Mary.
So we referenced the students who are here today, and they are a tough act to follow because I got to catch part of the reception with Jim, and they had some great questions to ask him, so I'm kind of treading on your steps there. And I'll start by saying, I know Koch Industries, I know that you bought Guardian, we covered it in Crane's Detroit Business, but tell us a little bit about the macro of Koch and also what your footprint is in Michigan.
Sure, Mary, thank you. Excuse me. So, for starters, I'm going to guess that when people heard Coke was going to be here today, and you hadn't seen the program yet, you might have thought it was going to be a beverage company from Atlanta. And that's really been true about Koch Industries for years. We're maybe the biggest company you hadn't heard of until we came into a community like this and acquired Guardian. And so, the reason for that is really twofold. One is we're a large private company, and we haven't been that vocal and that visible in the past. We may talk a little bit more about that later. The second reason is our name's generally not on our products. Sure, we sell some consumer products, so if you buy, when you buy Ronnie paper towels and Vanity Fair napkins and Dixie Plate and Cup and Stainmaster carpet, those are all products that we make in various of our businesses. But really, most of the time, we're the name behind the products. And so we're in a very wide and diverse group of businesses that range from refining and chemicals of transportation fuels, ranching, we're in fertilizers, we're in electronics and medical devices, we're in software, we're in glass, we're in automotive, and a range of chemical and chemical technology and trading businesses across the platform. So a very, very diverse group of companies. And maybe what's most fascinating is the transformation that's happened at Coke since really in the early 1960s, it was a small engineering company in Wichita, Kansas. Today, that's a diverse set of companies with over 120,000 people in more than 60 countries around the world. About 65,000 of those people are in the U.S., and about 1,700 of those are here in the state of Michigan. So this is an important state for us. And I'll tell you, in addition to Guardian being headquartered in Auburn Hills, the headquarters for our transportation and industrial business in Molex, which is in Chicago, is headquartered here in Rochester. We've got a number of Georgia-Pacific facilities around the state. And so all in, like I said, 1,700 people, about $60 million directly in wages and benefits in the state. So one of the more important states. And if I can maybe bring a tie back to me personally now. My wife is from South Carolina. And so I met my wife, actually, at Cooper's and Library, which is where I work. And I offered my very first words to her with my foot in my mouth. I'd been told that she went to Michigan. And I said, I heard you're a Wolverine. And her first words to me were, I've never been so insulted in all my life. This is a true story. And so very shortly after that, when we started dating and got married, I learned very quickly that my favorite team was Michigan State. And I'm sorry to say my second favorite team was whoever's playing Michigan. And so Sunday I was glued to the TV, as you might imagine. So Michigan does have a personal connection for me. My father-in-law, in fact, still lives here in St. Clair Shores. So lots of connections.
So just briefly, you gave us a little trajectory for the company. How did you come to be at Coke? What was your career path after becoming a CPA?
So I was at Cooper's and Lybrand before it was PricewaterhouseCoopers for about 6 years as an auditor, and ultimately, in a very common tale, went to work for a client of mine in the gold mining industry. And so for about 5 years, I was the corporate controller of two different public companies in that space. And then ultimately, I ended up at Coke. And ironically, when I got the call from somebody that said they wanted to talk to me about Coke, and they wanted me to come to Wichita, I actually said, foot in mouth once again, I thought that was in Atlanta. And so I really have this foot in the mouth thing down. But ultimately, I came to Coke in 1998, and I've been there for a little over 20 years then as a result of that. And you heard a little bit of my background. I was a CFO of a division of Coke for about 7 years. I ran an intermediate chemicals business as the president for a couple of years in Vista. and then was the CEO of Georgia Pacific for about 10 before moving into my current role. So.
And I told Jim over lunch, if he doesn't have the t-shirts now, he absolutely should have the t-shirts for the employees in Atlanta. Things go better than Coke, you know. So, but today's topic is the role of business, and we're going to talk a little bit about corporate responsibility. And, you know, in business journalism, we really kind of look at things in, as we do our storytelling, who's making money, who's losing money, and why are those, what's behind those two outcomes. But you've got this whole thing with the philosophy and the company of market-based management, a book by Charles Koch, Good Profit. Can you talk a little bit about that in terms of corporate responsibility?
Sure. And so I'll step back and say that we look at the role of business maybe differently than some others do. And I'll start by saying that a lot of companies, particularly those that are public, tend to focus on short-term profits and on shareholder value over short-term. And in fact, by the way you asked that question, indicates that that's something you've seen before. We tend to take the long-term view, and our focus is long-term value creation through mutual benefit, where we only benefit to the extent that we create value for our customers and the constituencies that we're part of. And so more specifically, what we'd say the role of business is to help people improve their lives by providing products and services that they value more highly than their alternatives, doing so responsibly and while consuming fewer resources. And I realize that's a mouthful, but we're very intentional about that purpose. And what I would then say is, to your point on making money, over the long term, as we look at that, if we do all those things well, right, then our profitability over the long term should be a measure of the value we create in society. And that's generally our broad philosophy. And we don't necessarily separate that from corporate responsibility, as an example. And really, the foundation of that goes back to Charles Koch. Charles Koch is our president and CEO, and maybe we'll talk a little bit about him later. But Charles, in the 1960s, really started to look at business through the lens of win-win relationships. And that became the foundation of what we call market-based management, which is our business philosophy, or the framework that we use to run the business day in and day out. And it's based on this concept of mutual benefit. And we think about that concept really in everything we do. So whether that's working with businesses or our business and our customers, whether that's working with the communities we're in, or any groups we might work with across the nation or across the political spectrum, our focus is always on this concept of mutual benefit. And so it's important to our company, it's important to our employees. And what we would say about that is we want to work with anyone to do right, to improve people's lives through mutual benefit. And that's generally our approach to how we think the role of business fits with what maybe is our overall vision at Koch Industries.
So yesterday I had the opportunity to hear Bill Ford talk about corporate responsibility from Ford Motor Company's perspective. Not just the push towards EVs and autonomous vehicles, but reducing waste stream and things like that. And I know that's part of what you're talking about too. So why don't you tell us a little bit about that?
Sure. So maybe I'll cover two things with this. And the first is, you heard me say, while consuming fewer resources. And so when we think about our role in business, one of the things we're always trying to do is to satisfy unmet needs with the lowest possible use of resources. And that's not a recycling statement. It's not a corporate sustainability statement. It really is how we operate our business. And so if you think about all the resources we use, it doesn't matter whether I mean raw materials, energy, or human resources, or capital. They're all either finite or they have alternatives. So that to the extent that we can't do that more efficiently and effectively than others, then we shouldn't be in business. So that's generally our approach, and manifests itself in our operations in all of our businesses. So maybe I'll use a Guardian example. So in our glass plants, we pack and sell about 85% of the glass we produce. The other 15% is waste in the process, and scrap we then take back. We call it cullet. We run it through a process that allows us to recycle that into the system. And so ultimately, 99.9% of the product we produce ends up in our finished products. So that closed loop is an example of us trying to use every resource that we can to create value. In addition to that, if you look at any of our assets, and the Guardian plants are a great example, we're constantly thinking about, with innovation and with our transformation organization, how do we become more energy efficient? How do we improve our productivity? How do we use fewer resources to produce these products? And that leads to lower energy consumption, lower emissions, and all the kinds of things you would think about in the context of of that corporate sustainability discussion. It just fits directly in our vision. The second thing I would point to is this idea of good profit. And the reason I want to hit that briefly is, in addition to just fewer resources, we use the word responsible. And there what we mean is we want the market. And by the market, I don't mean the stock market. I mean consumers, customers, suppliers. We want the marketplace to decide which companies, which products, which solutions win or lose over time. We don't want the government to pick winners and losers. So what we then think about is we're against corporate mandates, we're against subsidies, and we're against other policies that rig the system in favor of one over another and creates winners and losers. And I'll create an example for that to help you understand how that manifests itself day to day in our business. So we're the fifth largest producer of ethanol in the U.S. And ethanol production has been the beneficiary of subsidies and mandates for a long period of time. And those of you in the auto business, I'm certainly familiar with this. We have lobbied since the beginning of our investments in that business to get rid of the mandates and get rid of the subsidies. To date, we've gotten rid of the subsidies. We've been unsuccessful yet on the mandates. All of those benefit our bottom line, but we don't think it's good policy. And so we continually lobby against it. So what we mean by good profit is we want to profit by the economic means, not the political.
So one of the things that, you know, when I heard that you were coming in to speak, I had an image and I had a concept of Koch Industries based on popular media, mainstream media mostly. And I knew it was a very successful privately held company. I knew it was created by two brothers and one is still active. But I also knew that there was a lot of activity around what you just talked about, public policy. And political things. And so the mainstream image is that there's a lot of influence that the Koch brothers or Koch Industries have in trying to change policy or support causes that that they believe in. And so I want to give you a chance to talk a little bit about that, because it seems like in the last couple of years, this very private company has become a little more public, at least in trying to explain who you are and what you stand for.
Sure, that's the first I've heard of it. No, so let me start with one small clarification. Charles Koch is our chairman and CEO. David Koch, his brother, actually retired from the company and from all other activities a while back. And that's really due to health reasons. So I will tell you that it's really Charles that runs the company now. Charles, I can tell you from very close personal firsthand experiences, still very involved and very hard charging. And I think he will be, maybe long after me, I don't know how he's doing it, pretty incredible, but he's unbelievable. But with that said, all of this comes down to one simple question for Charles. And is this improving people's lives? And that's how we think about all these things. I told you, as we think about the world of business, that's our goal. That is every bit as true for everything Charles does as it relates to his commitment to try and tackle the problems that challenge our society. And all of us are committed to those kinds of things. And so he has a vision for society based on equal rights and mutual benefit. And that vision says that people succeed by helping other people succeed. And that is the way we approach what we're doing, whether it's inside the company or outside, as I said earlier. And so we understand we can't solve every problem, but what we try to do is find those opportunities to remove barriers that are holding people back. And then we try to work with folks who we agree with on those to solve problems. And so, as an example, really, with the current administration and the Obama administration before, we've worked on criminal justice reform in an area trying to remove huge barriers to an enormous number of people across America, particularly those that are least advantaged. I don't know how many of you know this, but we have relatively draconian sentencing laws in this country. In the U.S., we have 5% of the population in the world. We have 25% of the world's prisoners. If that doesn't bother you, it probably should. Because think about that, what that means for people creating value in society and using their innate abilities to make a difference. 25% of the world's prison population is in the U.S. So we've been very proud to have worked with a broad coalition, including the administrations I described, to pass in the end of last year a bill that's going to help people re-enter society out of prison better than they went in. First Step Act. By the way, you might note that's not called the Last Step Act. There's more work to do, but that's something we're very focused on. It's an example of the kind of things we're working on. Now, having said that, I would tell you, we know we're not going to agree with everyone on everything. No question about that. And so what Charles often says to us is a quote from Frederick Douglass. He says, Frederick Douglass said, I'll work with anyone to do right and no one to do wrong. And that's really the goal we have, whether we're working with communities, with other businesses, with governments, or with the educational system. That's our focus.
Yeah, you know, when I was doing some research to prepare for today, I did see the criminal justice reform, which is a big issue in Detroit for re-entering citizens. That's the new terminology. And frankly, businesses who are starving for talent, they're looking at new ways of getting people back in the workforce. So that was a very surprising initiative that the company had been engaged in. There are two other ones that I thought were worth mentioning. One is the Hispanic Libra initiative that is really helping people remove barriers to them being productive citizens and working. And then the United Negro College Fund, $25 million for African American students who want to study entrepreneurship and innovation. So I just thought that those are kind of surprising things, and you don't really read about them that much.
I think our communications folks are going to want to hire you, Mary. That was well done.
Well, mainstream media does not cover that.
Well, no, that's fair. And here's what I would say. First of all, all of those are things that we were involved in and we're very proud of. And they're things we've been advocating for 50 years in many cases. It's not new to folks in the organization. What has changed is what you said at the outset, which is we've made a much more concerted effort to tell our story a little more openly, and we're trying to find ways to connect more broadly across the U.S. with what we stand for. And so really there we're talking about uniting through collaboration individuals and organizations who are co-minded and like-minded around that commitment to making people's lives better and work with them. And so there's lots of other examples. We're working with Mike Rowe to help people understand and highlight the skills gap, because the skill trades are critically important to business. We're working with Deion Sanders and some organizations in Dallas to help people in poverty find a pathway to meaningful work out of poverty. And as we talked about, we're doing a lot of work with criminal justice, and you might be surprised to find that we have worked very, very closely with Van Jones on criminal justice reform. And so what all of these collaborations have in common, and this is an important point, is this belief that all the collaborators have, that every one of us and every one of these people we're talking about has enormous potential to contribute. And we have to help them find a way by breaking down barriers and finding opportunities.
So I have to ask at least one question about how you would differentiate the views and the things that you just talked about and President Trump's policies. I think that there was a big win with corporate tax reform, but from my reading, there's a little bit of a gap on tariffs and on immigration.
Pretty accurate. So first, I don't want to make a political discussion of this, and truthfully, that isn't my role at Coke. From what I've said, I do where I spend my time is helping the Coke companies. But as it relates to the current administration, there are, in fact, places that we see eye to eye, and criminal justice reform was one. We worked very closely together on the First Step Act. And really, removing barriers through the elimination of excessive regulation, things that have been stifling business and stifling innovation, is enough. The areas you mentioned, trade and immigration, are areas we don't see eye to eye. And really, if I think about those, if we look over history, that tells us that countries or times in history that have been the most prosperous have been also the most open trade environments. And then finally, as it relates to immigration, our view is that people who want to come here to do good should be allowed to come to the U.S. to do it. And that's generally our thought process.
So I think a lot of people in the room would probably like to hear a little bit about you're this large privately held company with lots of different business units. Many of them compete in very tough markets. And you mentioned earlier that you wanted to provide the good or the service better than someone else. How do you be a winner in a tough market?
It's a good question. And we've yet to find, if you guys know of one, I'd like to know about a business that's not tough and very competitive. But, you know, I mean, a lot of it has to do with the culture we try to develop in our organization with our market-based management framework and our guiding principles, which I haven't really talked about, but we have a set of guiding principles that define our culture. And those include things like integrity, compliance, and stewardship, but they also include things like transformation, respect, and principled entrepreneurship. And those define the culture we're trying to create, but they also help us think about how we apply it. And so one of the areas specifically with your question about how do we deal with this rapidly changing environment we're in, is we think about the forces, what we call the winds of creative destruction. And what that really means is in all of our businesses, the market, and again, this is our competitors, potential competitors, anyone you can think of who's trying to better meet the needs of our customers, are constantly trying to find new process, new methods, new products, new solutions to solve problems. And so we've got to have a mindset internally that we can't be complacent with success, and that we've got to drive that creative destruction in our own businesses. We have to destroy our own businesses with new products, methods, services, et cetera. And we have to have that be part of our culture. And I think that's what we've done over time, not always successfully, but that's been our culture. Maybe I can share an example here. In Georgia Pacific, we make a lot of paper. And we make, towels and napkins for away from home use. And so if you think about, for example, some innovative products we've developed that have controlled dispensing, if you've been in the washroom and you waved your hands in front of the machine and it dispensed the towel, controlled amount of towel, it's probably an in-motion machine. We've got a very large share of that market. And what I would tell you is we brought that to market before anyone else did, and it's grown tremendously. What you wouldn't know from that is it solved a huge problem. How many times have you been in a fast food restaurant or in a public washroom where there were towels and napkins all over the floor, all over the garbage, all over the place? There's a huge amount of waste. So we brought this innovation to market, knowing full well from the studies we've done, we were going to reduce the paper consumption in these facilities by 30 to 40%. But we knew it was the right thing to do because it used fewer resources, it created value for our customers, it improved the experience of their users, and over time, it created a loyalty with our customers that allows us to bring them innovation and them to be seriously interested in it, and allows us to win with our customers over and over and over again. That's the kind of win-win relationship we need to have, but it's also the kind of place we have to creatively destroy our own business. Because what we displaced in most cases was our own folded napkins, folded towels, and those kinds of things.
So talk a little bit about technology and the investment that it takes to kind of support some of the innovation that you've described.
So maybe I'll hit this two ways. First, we've made a lot of investment over the last 5 or 6 years into technology. So $15, $16 billion into tech space. That includes data analytics, software, components and solutions, sensors. And then the second piece is we're really having to transform all of our existing businesses digitally, but to bring them into the future and make them competitive long term. And so that involves us trying to find opportunities to bring our capabilities to bear across the platform. And when I say that, one of the things that's unique about Coke is we don't view ourselves as an industry player in a bunch of industries. We are. But we really look across and say we're a collection of capabilities, and we're looking for opportunities to apply those capabilities to create value. And that's how we led to Guardian as an example. We felt like capabilities we had would be valuable at Guardian, and they had capabilities that would make us better. And so we made that acquisition, brought those two things together, and we developed new capabilities and pursue new opportunities. Internally, we actually call that virtuous cycles of mutual benefit. And it's actually how we've grown Coke Industries over that, you know, 60 to 70 years I described earlier. And that's a place we've spent a lot of time and focus. And then finally, I'll just say in that space as an example, we made an investment in a company called Infor. It's ERP software. It's the third largest to SAP and Oracle. Forget those two names, focus on Infor. How those come together, though, to leverage the capabilities, they had tons of digital transformation experience with our customers. They also had tools we could use. So we've implemented their Cloud Suite financials at the corporate level and in some of our biggest businesses. We're implementing their ERP software in several of our big businesses, as well as our asset management platform. And we're also putting in human capital management across all 120,000 employees across the country. That's going to give us some efficiency, but more importantly, it's going to let us tap into those capabilities across the organization. It's going to drive tremendous value. So here's an example of them bringing some capabilities to help us. In the meantime, we've become a great customer. We're a great reference for them, and we're out there helping them sell product based on a huge company that's global deploying their products and having lots of success. So a real win-win there as well. So that's kind of how we think about these capabilities coming together.
So we mentioned the students earlier, and there are students here today that are part of a program, Youth Entrepreneurs. And I think there's a big thing happening here. You want to get into the YE part?
Sure. So Youth Entrepreneurs is one of the areas we invest in education, and it was started by Liz and Charles Koch 30 years ago in Wichita, Kansas. The program, YE as we call it, is here in Detroit now as well. And I could spend some time explaining it to you, but quite frankly, we've got a video about the program in Detroit that we're going to go ahead and show you. So if you could roll the video, please.
The city of Detroit is facing a lot of difficult challenges. Deteriorating neighborhoods, poverty, there's crime. When it comes to graduation rates, one in three African Americans will not graduate. One in four Hispanics will not graduate. There is so much outside noise that our students have to deal with.
The greatest barrier that I've seen so many of my students have to overcome is that self-esteem barrier. They've seen so much failure and not enough success, and so they don't believe that they can be successful.
They have all the ability, just like any other student, to accomplish whatever they want to. It's a matter of finding a way to get that out of them. I found out about Youth Entrepreneurs from a former colleague about 2 years ago. Youth Entrepreneurs is an organization that helps students develop an entrepreneurial spirit. It's an elective course that teaches students business principles and life skills that are very vital to their success out in the real world.
Jason and I went to a teacher training in Wichita last summer, and it was so phenomenal. We have brought it back and implemented it in our classrooms nonstop every since.
This is not your typical business class. It's much more engaging, much more open, much more moving, and the kids seem to just take on that and love it.
The fact that they're throwing paper airplanes and creating them, that they're understanding rapid prototyping and sunk costs and scarcity. It is when we're throwing tennis balls and buckets that they're understanding the law of diminishing marginal returns. We're all jumping up and down because we all understand the concepts now.
The curriculum is very easy to understand. It's simple to put into your classroom. The way it's implemented really transforms students' lives and opens up so many doors and so many lanes of opportunity that they might not otherwise receive.
Before YE, I thought business was impenetrable, like, institution that nobody could get into.
We was just like a whole bunch of men in suits. They just wanted money. YE has just made it seem like I could have a seat at that table without being like that.
It's amazing to be able to say that we're 17, we are Black, and we're entrepreneurs.
I'm Ariane.
I'm Akila.
I'm Charity Turbo.
And I'm Leah Gross.
And we are
Color Creations.
So Color Creations is an all-natural skincare line that the four of us created our junior year of high school.
Everything is natural, handmade. We're labeled organic or a vegan.
Financially, it is profitable. It's been very lucrative so far.
YE is set apart from other classes just because it allows you to step out of that comfort zone. It gives you the hope to start a business, but it also gives you those core values that you can take into the real world.
After YE, I found my confidence in myself and the ability to make products such as this.
We all have worked very hard for the things that we wanted throughout high school, and then this is just another representation of our hard work. Just putting that forward in college and throughout the rest of our life is just very important.
99% of YE graduates go on to finish their high school diploma, and one-third of those students go on to actually start their own business. It shows kids that there's a way out, that they are not tied to what their family before them did.
Because they've stepped out of a comfort zone, they're able to break through some barriers that they may have had previously.
They have the ability and they can learn the knowledge to aspire to whatever goal they put in front of themselves.
There's always that one child that you may have just changed their life forever. And you definitely did that with us, so
yeah.
We appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
cool. So 10 schools, YE schools in the region, but you are bringing more to Detroit this summer.
We are. So we're in 10 schools, and by the way, on your tables is a list of the schools that we're in today. And Detroit is a fabulous place for this, and we think there's a huge opportunity, partly because of the manufacturing and the entrepreneurial background here, and partly, quite frankly, because we've got Guardian Industries here, and they're big sponsors and supporters. Ron Voppel, the CEO here, finds this to be one of the most important programs we're working on, and he's a huge supporter. So this summer, we're going to bring their annual summit here, and we'll have hundreds of students, educators, alumni, all here talking about how they can make a bigger and better impact in the organization, but also here on Detroit. And it's a great place to bring this, given what's happening with the revitalization of the city. You were mentioning to me over lunch what you were doing yesterday, talking about the things that are going on with the train station, the development that's happening downtown. There's a tremendous number of great stories about revitalization in Detroit that I think make this a great place for YE to really take hold. So what I would ask of you is there's more material on your tables. There are students here, as we said, and there's also some folks from YE here. And you might find them and see how you can get involved after we're done today. So thank you very much.
And now we're going to shift back to Angie Kelly for the Q&A portion of the program.
Well, thank you all for your questions, too. We've got some great ones that have come in. The first one is, how much of an impact did the recession have on your business? And what is your current outlook for continued growth?
So it's a good question. The recession back in really in 08 and 09 was obviously unprecedented for many of us. And all of our businesses, I would say, suffered pretty big hits in demand. In some places, we found we were reasonably prepared for it. In other places, we were woefully underprepared for the magnitude of those changes. And I think, you know, relatively quickly, we learned where we had good muscle that was working well to deal with it and where we didn't, and we made changes. But it was a very trying time in a number of our businesses. It also, though, created an opportunity for us. And because we, and I haven't said this to you, but our shareholders have historically and continually reinvested 90% of the earnings back into the business. So this ties both to the first part and the second part of the question. That gave us the opportunity during that downturn to start doing some acquisitions where we felt like we could be stronger coming out of the recession than we went in. And so we did some of that as well. And then as it relates to our outlook for growth, one of the students today told me there's going to be a recession in December of 2019, I think. I'm not sure that's exactly when, but I do think it is going to happen at some point in the future. Right? And so we're going to be better prepared for that because we've got the muscle memory from the last one. But we're also focused on continuing to find those places where our capabilities can be leveraged to find new opportunities to create value. And that really is a cross-coke discussion. And I think the next recession is going to actually create much more opportunity for us when that does happen. In the meantime, we continue to focus on investments that we think add value in an incredibly rapidly changing and disrupted world.
You mentioned that you live in Atlanta and you're very involved in the community there. Atlanta seems to be booming. And the question is, what lessons can Detroit take from Atlanta to try to even further propel our growth here?
So first off, I'd say y'all are doing pretty good because nationally you're getting a lot of attention. And that's a good thing. And I heard a couple of different programs about bringing folks who have been successful back here that seem to be really taking hold with investment. So those are all great. I don't know enough about Detroit to say what you are and aren't doing, other than to say I've heard a lot of positive things. What I can tell you has happened in Atlanta is really kind of twofold. One is the business community and the government have closely tied their horses. And the mayor of the city of Atlanta, for example, has a group called the Committee for Progress, which you heard I'm a member of. That they actually work through what should the priorities for the city be and how can we work together to implement those to make the city stronger, more attractive, more viable in every respect. And those priorities get reset every year, and those two organizations, those institutions work together to do that. The second is the city has had the fortunate leadership that has focused on making sure the finances were sound and the city was in a good place to the extent we do get another recession. Because one of the things that happened in Atlanta, like a lot of cities, when we had the last recession is the reserves went down and the revenues went down, and suddenly the city had a budget it couldn't cover with its revenues. And so they made a lot of difficult choices in restructuring the way that the government worked, and they really improved its operational flexibility and capability. And they partnered effectively locally And the last thing they did was they really worked well with the governor so that the city of Atlanta, which much like I think would be true in Michigan, although I don't know this, is by far the biggest economic engine for the state of Atlanta or the state of Georgia. I would assume Detroit is the same for the state of Michigan. And so they worked closely with the governor to make sure priorities were aligned at the state level as well. All of those things have made Atlanta really prosperous over the last, 10 years since the recession, and a focal point for Fortune 500 and other big companies to move, and a lot of students to want to stay after they finish school at all the educational institutions around Atlanta.
I'm going to combine two questions here. So Koch Enterprises seems to be involved in many different industries. What are the unique challenges about being so broadly based? And also, how do you personally manage such a broad portfolio?
So that is a great question. It's true. They're very, very diverse in terms of what markets they're in. What I would tell you, and I got into this a little bit with the response to the question on technology, but it used to be that if you were in refining and you were in papermaking and you were in fertilizer, those businesses were completely different. What's happened over the last, let's call it 10 years, right, since you all got a smartphone and we watched what was happening, data, search, storage, analytics, those things have all essentially become free. Right? The cost of all those things is almost zero. Communication, all those things. In addition to that, the technology has advanced such that we can get information about what's happening in our operations, in our supply chain, from our customers in real time with sensors and other tools that are all, again, incredibly affordable compared to even just 5 years ago. What that's done is actually changed a lot of the problems we work on from being vertical problems to being horizontal problems. In other words, we're trying to think about how do we use IoT, big data, and machine learning in refining, in fertilizer, in papermaking, and the problems are actually the same. So we're learning to leverage that across the enterprise and become more capable that way. And so from that perspective, that's one way. The second thing is, I mentioned market-based management and our culture. And first and foremost, every Coke company approaches their business through the lens of that philosophy and the culture driven by those guiding principles. And that is something we work on every single day. It is how we attract, develop, retain, and reward our people. It's how we think about being preferred partners with the folks we work with, whether that's a supplier, a local government, an employee, or a customer. We think about how we want to be treated and how we want to treat them. And that set of guiding principles in our management philosophy is consistent across all those organizations. And that's really the only way I could ever be involved enough to be connected in all of those businesses.
So you've been with the organization now for over 20 years, you mentioned. And as you know, a lot of people these days change companies frequently. What are your thoughts on the positive of staying with one organization for a lengthy period?
So I would say first, shame on the companies. So if we can't keep people, that's our fault, it's our problem. If we can't create an environment where people have the opportunity, as I said earlier, to use their innate abilities, and we can help them develop valued skills, and then put them in an environment where they're continuous and lifelong learners, always finding new ways, right? I'll call this virtuous cycles for our employees. If we're not finding that path for our people, making it so that on Sunday night, nobody's saying, crap, I have to go to work tomorrow. They're saying, I can't wait to get in there. And they're engaged in that way, then why would we ever lose anyone that we don't want to lose? First of all, I would say that is my thought process about how we think about employees. And my view with a Coke company is that's what we're trying to do for everyone. So that would be the direct answer. If you come to Coke, I don't think you're going to leave, because that's what we're trying to do. We're trying to help you become, and we're trying to create an environment where we all can become more fully self-actualized and be all that we can be, to put it in Maslow's sort of simplified way.
Can you talk further about Coke's involvement in the automotive industry specifically, particularly around the future of mobility and autonomous
driving? Sure. So that is a big topic for us. We are, just to give you some background, we make about 5% of the gasoline in the country, so transportation fuels. We make about 50% of all the fiber that goes into airbag in the world. We make every Ford F-150 grill. We make lots of painted and chrome parts for auto all over the world. And then we are in automotive in a big way in Molex, making connectors and solutions. As it specifically relates to electrification and to automation, we're doing a number of things. First, on the electrification side, we're working on battery management systems and capabilities that support that in Molex and in Guardian, and working together on those things. We're also working across those companies on solutions around radar, for example, and radomes, the covers. As you might guess, in February in Detroit, if you're relying on radar and your radar is behind a cover, might have some stuff on it, maybe ice and snow. Figuring out how to solve that problem is something we're working on as an example. We launched last year at CES the first 10 gigabit Ethernet backbone for autonomous vehicles. And we're working now with a number of different customers that will be in the market with that this fall. And if you think about autonomous, one of the big problems we're gonna have to solve, and every one of us is gonna require it, is that vehicle has to have no latency time, right? In terms of when it gets data and it reacts to data, or we're not gonna believe it's safe. And that's in the vehicle and everything that's around it, right? And so we're building the architecture to do that without adding 9 million cables and about a million pounds of weight to every vehicle. And so mobility in general for us is a pretty big topic at Coke. It's something we spend a lot of time on, and we're partnering with our OEM partners on doing some of the things I just described.
So this was one of the disruptive technologies that Coke's investing in, and there was recent news about Chase Coke and disruptive technologies. Can you talk a little bit more about other disruptive
technologies? Sure. We didn't talk a lot about this today, but every industry has been, is being, or will be disrupted. That's our view anyway. And as we see that happening, one, if you think about my comments on creative destruction, we want to be doing that to ourselves. Two, if that's going to happen, things are going to change, right? Incumbents that have been in place for a long time may get disrupted. We'd like to understand where that might happen and take advantage of it. So we set up this organization that Chase Coke, Charles' son, runs. And that organization is out looking for relatively early stage investments in disruptive technologies. Some that were related to businesses we're in that might disrupt our own businesses, and some that we think are going to disrupt other businesses. So, for example, we've made investments in focused MRI for treatment of brain-related issues, a company out of Israel that we think is going to revolutionize treatment for a number of disorders, eventually potentially including Parkinson's. We've made an investment in a company called Desktop Metal that does additive manufacturing, so digital printing with metals. We're taking prototype assets into our business in one of our robotics businesses, in our Molex business, and we've got other people standing in line across Coke to try this stuff, to build it into our supply chains and add capability for us and for them. So we're pursuing all kinds of disruptions, some of which are directly related to our businesses, some of which are external, and we felt like that would be difficult to do in any one business because, as all of you know in your own organizations, it's kind of hard on any given day to get out of the way of the priorities that are sitting in front of you. And so we felt like we needed this on the outside, and we've connected them all across Coke, and we call that actually the Coke Lab. So if you're an entrepreneur with a great idea or a great business, and you want to work with somebody who can help you determine whether it's real, accelerate it, and make it happen, we can not only make an investment, but we can bring you into the Coke Lab and accelerate it because we have all this expertise in all these different businesses. And that's sort of the theory behind it. And that's an early stage, as you said. It's only been a little over a year since we started that.
Well, we like to wrap up the questions with lightning round questions for you. So we'll fire these off one after another. But can you share something that's on your bucket list?
I'd like to go to every Major League Baseball park. And I did go to Tiger Stadium the last game.
Oh, wow. How about a person other than a family member that you'd like to talk to?
Oh, I didn't say other than a family member. I was certainly going to say my wife, Susan. let's see, a person I'd like to have lunch with. I would like to have lunch with the Dalai Lama.
How about one of your favorite songs?
It Won't Be Like This For Long by Darius Rucker. Makes me think of my three daughters.
How about your favorite team growing up?
The New York Yankees. I'm from Connecticut originally. We didn't say that.
What was your best sport? Or what is your best sport?
Was basketball. Now probably golf. I'm not that good.
What is the last book that you read?
Sticking to the basketball theme, I just am finishing a book called The Legends Club, which I would recommend. A great book about the three coaches within 20 miles around Charlotte, North Carolina.
And how about one of your favorite movies?
Tombstone.
Favorite vacation spot?
Any beach.
Especially after Detroit.
Warm beach. No, not just after Detroit. Come on, I didn't say that.
This is one of my favorites. It's describe Detroit in one word.
Motown.
And how about advice that you give to your 25-year-old self?
Learn more about technology.
And then say Spartans when she asks.
And say Spartans when she asks. Good point.
Right.
I was older than 25. You're right. I should have done that.
Well, thank you, Jeff.
Thank you.
Appreciate your
Thanks, everybody.
All right, well, Jim Hannon, thank you so much for traveling from Atlanta to be with us and for your leadership. One more round of applause, please, for Jim.
Thank you.
Mary Kramer, you've already had a busy week with your event yesterday and ours today, so thank you for your time today and your expertise. Angie Kelly, terrific job as presiding officer. Ladies and gentlemen, we thank you for coming. Hope to see you Friday at the Detroit Red Wings event. This meeting is now adjourned. Thank you.